This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on November 21st, 2013. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Morning. The open meeting for the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, November 21st, 2013 will now come to order. We have a number of late submitted documents. Mr. Vice Chairman, would you do the honors?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider the late submission of agenda document numbers 13-45-B, 13-49, 13-47, and 13-48. Thank you.
Thank you. The Vice Chairman has moved that we waive the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents so that we may consider agenda documents 13-45B, 13-49, 13-47, and 13-48. Any discussion on the motion? If not, I'll call the question. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries 6-0. First item on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2013-15 from Conservative Action Fund. This is the Bitcoin AO again. Mr. Backer, I'm sure that at some time today, someone is going to want to ask you a question, so why don't you come on down and sit at the table and be ready for that.
Thank you.
You're giving us a lot of business today.
Always happy to help. Can I get my frequent flyer card?
We appreciate it. I did want to note that in addition to some very interesting questions on the agenda, we also got some very interesting comments, and comments from outside of what we call the usual suspects, the folks from the Inside the Beltway election law bar, who we appreciate very much that they often comment as well as make requests of us, but it's also very nice to hear from people who are not from the usual suspects, who come from outside the Beltway and are citizens who are affected by what we do here and are paying attention. And we appreciate that you're paying attention. We appreciate that you took the time to comment. So I want to say a special thank you to those folks. We did read your comments, and we're happy to have them. Ms. Selenkoff, would you like to give us a recap of where we are?
Certainly. Thank you, Chair Weintraub. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda documents 13-45, 45A, and 45B present four draft advisory opinions in response to a request by Conservative Action Fund, a non-connected political committee that wishes to accept, as noted, bitcoins, a privately issued digital currency. At last week's meeting, the Commission discussed three of these drafts. Agenda document 13-45B presents a new fourth draft that's been made public since the last meeting. CAF asks 24 questions, which generally fall into three categories. The first category of questions concerns whether CAF may accept bitcoins, and all four drafts conclude that CAF may accept bitcoins as in-kind contributions. The drafts diverge in their conclusions as to whether the bitcoins are money. The first draft, what I'll call Draft A, concludes that they are not money, and drafts B, C, and D do not resolve this question. The second category of questions concerns deposit valuation and reporting. All four drafts conclude that Bitcoin should be deposited, valued, and reported like other in-kind contributions. They differ in some respects as to what kind of in-kind contribution, with Draft D providing a slightly different approach to the reporting of the in-kind contributions. Drafts B and D provide examples of how these contributions should be reported. The third category of questions concerns disbursements of bitcoins, and this is where the drafts diverge the most. Drafts A, B, and C conclude that CAF may not use bitcoins to make disbursements for goods and services. Instead, CAF must sell the bitcoins in order to get funds to make disbursements for this purpose. Drafts A and B similarly conclude that CAF must sell its bitcoins and deposit the proceeds in a campaign depository before it may use those funds to make contributions to other committees. Draft C concludes that CAF may contribute the bitcoins to other committees. Draft D, unlike the others, concludes that CAF may disburse bitcoins for both the purchase of goods and services and to make contributions to other committees. The Commission received two comments on the request and four comments on the drafts, as noted. If the Commission approves a draft, we ask for the authority to make technical and conforming changes, and I'm available to answer any other questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Selenkoff. Do we have any comments on any of the drafts? Mr. Vice Chairman.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I'd just like to observe that, Mr. Becker, thank you for bearing with us to work through what was, or is for some, still seemingly an exotic and novel issue. I've given it much thought, and I've come to the conclusion that we've been a little bit distracted by the novelty of bitcoins, and that that although they represent a unique and new type of asset, they are an asset. And they are an asset that can be used for the trade of goods and services, obviously. And it's intriguing that they're new and different in how they're transacted philosophically, economically, and technologically. But our regulatory treatment of bitcoins need not be distracted by those academic issues. Once we decide to fit bitcoins into our regulatory scheme as either money or a thing of value, and they are one or the other for purposes of a fork in the road for determining how we're going to regulate them, I think the legal question for the FEC is quite vanilla. The legal analysis starts with the clear and unambiguous statutory right that Mr. Backer's client has to give and receive contributions. There's no debate about that. Contributions are defined as anything of value. From the beginning of the Federal Election Campaign Act, the FEC has acknowledged that political committees can give and receive things of value, including in-kind contributions, and committees have done this regularly for decades. They've both given and received in-kind contributions. Our political committee guide advertises to the public on page 25 that political committees can give things of value in kind to other political committees. We encourage that, in fact, by advertising it to the public, and we countenance it on many reports that are filed with this committee. And there is a well-established set of rules for receiving, using, reporting, accounting for the disposition of, and reporting the contribution out of in-kind contributions, regardless of the asset classification and regardless of whether the item can fluctuate based on its dollar exchange value. So I believe that the Conservative Action Fund has a clear statutory right to give and receive in-kind contributions, regardless of what we say here today. What he really is asking us is how to. So that brings us to bitcoins. Bitcoins clearly are things of value to many people. They have purchasing value. They have trading value. They have U.S. dollar exchange value. And they can translate the U.S. dollar exchange value on any given day according to objective reference points. That makes bitcoins, in my mind, no different from any other in-kind contribution that political committees can give and receive today. Consider the types of in-kind contributions that this commission countenances already. Barter credit units. I don't know what a barter credit unit really is. I've never owned one. I've never bartered with credit units. But in 1982, in the Barter Pack AO, this commission said that political committees could both receive barter credit units on a private exchange and could expend them to obtain goods and services with barter credit units. I don't know that there's much distinction at the end of the day between a Bitcoin and a barter credit unit. Stock certificates, both publicly traded and non-publicly traded stock certificates. This commission has twice approved at least the receipt in of stock certificates, both in 2000 and 2000-30, the PAC.com advisory opinion, and in 1989-6, the Bollard advisory opinion. From there, they're silver dollars. This commission in 1980 and 1980-125, the Cogswell for Senate advisory opinion, said that a political committee could receive silver dollars that had a unit a dollar exchange value of greater than a dollar, and could both receive, could receive them, could re-gift them to other political committees, and could expend them for the purpose of purchasing services. There are any number of things of value that are like these bitcoins, and we have quite easily adapted our regulatory regime to regulate them. Bearer stock certificates, bearer bonds, treasury bonds. Treasury bonds exist both in an email exchange or in a piece of paper that represents the value of the treasury bond. But many treasury bonds now are nothing more than an electronic transfer with an account number on them, much like the zeros and O's that represent a Bitcoin. Frequent flyer miles in the transfer of frequent flyer miles. Generally, there's not a certificate that represents them. They exist on a computer somewhere. They're a credit account. And they can buy you flights on an airline. They can also, I bought my subscription to the Wall Street Journal with frequent flyer miles that were going to lapse. Prepaid money cards, gift certificates, and discounts from ordinary and usual charges. Something quite intangible, but given to people. And we tell political committees, account for the discount in your reporting as something of value that you received. There are any number of intangibles, electronic mailing lists, a license to use an electronic mailing list, a license to use software, intellectual property that is copyrighted material that we assign a value to. You can't see it or hold it, it's intellectual property, but we allow committees to receive value in kind of copyright to use in their political messaging. Rent is an intangible. And then there are a host of tangible items that we allow to be given, received, given, exchanged. Computers, food and beverages, furniture, photocopies and printing. And then, of course, there are services. Once we focus on the fact that the FEC has been able to regulate the receipt in, the contribution out, and transfer of all of these various types of in-kind contributions, the regulation of bitcoins starts to look quite conventional. Albeit a conventional regulatory construct applied to a new and different kind of asset. Now, Mr. Backer represents that his client understands the regulatory requirements that are applied to all other asset classes, and that his client is prepared to subject its receipt and transfer of bitcoins to the same regulations that have applied to all other types of in-kind assets. Any advisory opinion we issue would be premised upon compliance with the existing regulations, including accurate reporting of the name and address of each contributor and an accurate daily dollar valuation of the in-kind received. So, I want to repeat, the Conservative Action Fund does not need our permission to accept in-kind contributions of things of value, including bitcoins. That right inheres in the statutory right they already enjoy. What they need to know is how to handle them and how to account for them and how we want to see them reflected on their public reports. I also want to address one other point of interest, and that is the issue of anonymity and audit trail. Bitcoins are zipped electronically over the internet from one Bitcoin wallet to another Bitcoin wallet. And there is concern that somehow that gives rise to potential anonymity and false reporting of the donor. Well, that can occur on the whole host of assets that I just mentioned. There is no audit trail like a check if I give you a certificate of stock. It doesn't say who owned that certificate of stock on the day before I gave it to you. And we have remedies in place if somebody reports that they received a certificate of stock or a prepaid card or any other thing of value, including a Bitcoin from John Smith at 123 Maple Avenue at the end of the day, at the end of that audit trail, as a human being. And either John Smith resides and exists at 123 Maple Avenue and will take credit for having given 10 bitcoins to a political committee, or he will not. And if there is no John Smith there, or if John Smith is found and says, I never gave 10 bitcoins, there are remedies in law already for that under the name of another construct, including refunds and disgorgements. So with that, I'd like to say that I'm prepared to support draft D that is before the commission. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. And it's interesting. I agree with much of what you said, and I actually started out in a place that's very close to where you seem to have landed. When this request first came in, I thought, well, that's interesting. I will freely admit I had never heard of bitcoins before the request came in, but I think we do have constructs for dealing with this, and you know, we just have to figure out which box to put it in, and I thought actually it was going to be an easy one. But the more I dug into this, the more complicated it began to seem. And this is obviously a topic that's gotten a lot of attention from various actors in the federal government recently. There were two separate hearings on bitcoins just this week. And I spent a lot of time in my evenings this week going through that testimony. I noted that a branch of the Treasury Department seems to have spent quite a lot of time considering how to amend their rules in order to accommodate bitcoins and other similar. I don't even know how to describe it, whether we should describe it as a currency or whether we should describe it as a thing. And that's part of the problem. You know, I thought it was going to be simple, and then we ended up with four drafts in front of us that came to different conclusions at various junctures along the way. Mr. Backer came in, and I appreciate your coming in and saying you want to get it right. You want to know how to do this properly. We want to get it right, too. And for me, the one of the difficulties is that I think that when you come in with a request like this, and it's got 24 separate questions in it, it's really more amenable to the rulemaking context than it is to an AO context. And that is particularly because we've had many interesting discussions with Mr. Backer about various elements of campaign finance law. He's very experienced and erudite on that topic. But
thank you.
With all due respect, Mr. Backer, it does not appear that you are actually an expert on bitcoins.
No.
Yes, and I appreciate your acknowledging that, and we aren't either. And we've gotten some comments that are helpful, but the comments are somewhat inconsistent. And it's very difficult to assess on a piece of paper which one of them is right and which one of them is wrong, which is why it would be more useful if we address this topic through a rulemaking and had the opportunity to not only invite witnesses, but maybe do some real outreach and make sure we were getting the right witnesses and the right range of opinions, and not the right range of opinions, but all ranges of opinions, so that we could appropriately assess them and figure out what we have in front of us. We seem to have, we're not 100% sure whether it's currency or not currency. Is it analogous to a security or not so much like security, because the rules change and the answers to your questions change depending on which box we put it in. I had originally thought that I would be on my original impulse was closest to draft A, the original draft that our counsel prepared for us. But I think at this point, I am not comfortable voting for even that draft, because I'm not sure that it gets it right, and I'm not sure that we are in a position to make that call based on the information that's in front of us today, as helpful as I know you have tried to be, Mr. Backer. Bitcoins do raise some very interesting questions about whether disclosure can be adequately done with the best of intentions, when it is the bitcoins that are being transferred, and I'm not prejudging the answer to that. I just think there's a question there that I've read a lot about the way that bitcoins are used by people who are particularly seeking anonymity, and we have a statute that requires transparency. In addition, I have some concerns about what restrictions might need to be put in place to ensure that the bitcoins weren't coming from foreign sources. And I just don't know the answer to that right now, whether we would need special rules for that or not. I think that's a subject that we should probably explore in greater depth. We don't have a draft that says, no, you may not accept bitcoins, and I would not want to, because I don't think there's anybody who wants to vote for that draft. I know I wouldn't want to vote for that draft. What I think, what I've suggested to my colleagues, and this is an idea that I will admit popped into my head in about the last 24 hours, so we weren't able to pull together a document in time to propose this. But I think this might be an area where it might be appropriate for us to work together and with the advice of our counsel to try and craft an interim policy that would provide perhaps a little bit of breathing space for folks and not let people walk out of the room with the wrong impression that in not issuing an advisory opinion, the FEC was saying no to bitcoins. I'd be interested in working with my colleagues on trying to put out something like this, that on fairly short order, hopefully even by the end of the year. What I would envision is a policy that would have a sunset in it of perhaps a year, which would give us the time to do a rulemaking, to bring in witnesses so that we could adequately consider all of the issues here and come up with a rule going forward that would provide good guidance and would be appropriate to the vehicle that we're discussing. Congress, when it enacted the FICA, put in very low limits on donations that come in anonymously and donations that come in cash, and bitcoins seem to share some of those features. Obviously, there's no provision in the FICA that restricts bitcoins because they didn't exist when the statute was drafted, but I do think that Congress did have concerns about the kinds of contributions that lend themselves to anonymity and to cash transactions in order to protect the important disclosure function of the law. So I'm not saying no, but honestly, I don't think that I'm prepared to sign on to any of the drafts today or that we have the information in front of us from which I could conclude that any of these alternatives is the right alternative for Bitcoin. And as I said, you want to get it right, I want to get it right. I think that it might take a little bit more time and information for us to do this the way it ought to be done. Some topics just lend themselves more to rulemakings than to advisory opinion requests, and I think that this might be one of them. So that's where I am. Commissioner Ravel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to reiterate what's already been said, and I do also agree with much of what you said, Commissioner Goodman, but I come down exactly where you are, Madam Chair. I have a lot of concerns about the fact that there is so much unknown about bitcoins, and I too have been doing an inordinate amount of reading, and most recently I read an article that was in law360.com, and they quoted a U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs, which announced that they had initiated an inquiry into virtual currencies. And it says, the committee noted that, quote, the expansive nature of this emerging technology demands a holistic and whole government approach in order to understand and provide a sensible regulatory framework for their existence. And that is exactly what I believe is the case here. While we all want to encourage this new technology, and it's not just the technology, we want to encourage people to participate in the political process and give to candidates and other political matters. I think it's premature for us to make that determination now, and I like the approach that you have suggested to do an interim policy and then get information from others who are more knowledgeable about all the issues that were raised that are frankly of concern to me. And I think it's part of our regulatory obligations to ensure, despite the fact that we have no concerns about your organization and your client in terms of their goodwill and their desire to comply with our rules. I just would feel more comfortable if we take this a little more slowly.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me start off by echoing something you said earlier about some of the comments that we received from people and groups that we don't normally hear from on a regular basis, who added perspectives and information that I thought were very well taken and very interesting, and certainly provided greater context and understanding in an area where, like all my colleagues, I'm learning on the fly. I think we all are throughout the government, and also I think throughout the public. It seems like right now we're at a flashpoint where this is starting to capture the public's imagination, whereas maybe before it was more kind of it was known, but in certain circles it sounds like, just from coverage in the Washington Post, Time Magazine, other sources, it seems like it's now starting to garner sort of a national, garner the national's attention in a way that it hasn't before, and it certainly has piqued my interest as well. But having said that, I'm still, I mean, what I don't know so far outweighs what I do know about bitcoins, that I understand my colleagues' concerns about not exactly, still trying to grapple with what exactly we're dealing with here. And so it's not easy to completely wrap our arms around exactly what bitcoins are and what the full implications of their introduction into the campaign finance system are with respect to our regulatory regime. Notwithstanding that, Mr. Backer, on behalf of his client, presented a legitimate question through the advisory opinion process set forth in Section 437H of the Act, and under that, we are given 60 days to give an answer, and so sometimes I wish there were kind of an escape hatch provision in 437H, but we have to do something. And so I'm prepared to support Draft D. I think for many of the reasons that were set forth by the Vice Chair, I think it's the most coherent approach to dealing with this, with capturing bitcoins within our regulatory system. I'd note that all the drafts would allow the Conservative Action Fund to receive bitcoins as in-kind contributions, and then the question was, what could they do with them at that point? And I think under the facts as presented, I think certainly the most logically compelling rationale would be that not only can they receive, if they can receive them as in-kind contributions, then they should be able to also subsequently make in-kind contributions to other political committees, or then to use them to purchase goods and services. And I can't find, again, a compelling reason why that shouldn't be allowed under these circumstances. That was the approach that was taken in previous advisory opinions issued by this commission that the Vice Chair recounted well. The Cogswell AO dealing with the silver dollars, the Barter Pack AO dealing with the credit units. There's the different drafts deal interestingly with what the issue of stock. There was the Bevel AO, which is 1986-18, where money transferred from a campaign account into basically a securities account. I think it was called a cash management account, but then you could draw down from that account. Basically, in essence, it was another cash account, and we said that under the requirements that any disbursements come out of a depository of the campaign, any monies that may be in that cash management account need to be transferred back. And I think that was the right conclusion. Certainly, it's compelled by our regulations. Then there's the PAC.com advisory opinion in 2000. I think the official site is 2000-30, which used the Bevel advisory opinion as a precedent, but I'm not sure that it really fits. In this case, the question was if a committee receives an in-kind contribution in the form of stock, can it then subsequently make an in-kind contribution of that same stock? And the opinion said that no, you would have to first liquidate that. And I'm not sure that that really is compelled by the Bevel opinion, and I don't think it's compelled by our regulations. I mean, in some ways it looks the same, but I think that there is some difference. And I do think that the PAC.com advisory opinion is actually the outlier. I think the more consistent approach has been the approach that we saw in the earlier AOs, the Cogswell and the Barter PAC AOs. But having said that, I am at the appropriate time willing to support Draft D. If it doesn't pass, I think that something is always better than nothing. And like I said, I understand very clearly the concerns that my colleagues have with respect to what the introduction of Bitcoins into the campaign finance system might mean, and that having a little bit more time and especially more information from a variety of different voices would really, I think, educate us all and help us on that front. And I'd certainly be willing to work with my colleagues to craft an interpretive rule that would allow Bitcoins the regulatory breathing room that it needs in order to continue to develop technologically, while at the same time have that rule allow for transparency and put in place safeguards to make sure that Bitcoins couldn't serve as a vehicle for undermining the anti-corruption rationales underlying the act that we administer and enforce. So I'll be willing to I support Draft D. I think it's the correct one under the circumstances that as they're presented before us. Should it fail, I will be more than happy to work with my colleagues to find an interpretive rule that I think handles this in the best manner possible. Because I do think, I think you're you're riding the wave on this one, Mr. Backer, in the sense that this issue is, I think, not going to go away anytime soon. And I think we need to have something in place to provide further guidance, not only in terms of how do we categorize it, but what do you do in terms of valuation, in terms of proper reporting, and so forth. So that's where I am at the point.
Thank you. Commissioner Walther.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I'd like to say that Mr. Backer, you've done a great job trying to educate us as quickly as you can on something that's really hard to learn about. This so far is my Bitcoin library, and it's all been read, but not, of course, fully understood. And I think this is the concern that I have. I've come a long way in my own thinking in the last few weeks on this. I'm reluctant to call it a currency, but methodology for the time being. And I'm over the hump pretty much on the value issue. I'm really concerned about some of the issues that involve the actual handling of this type of property. But I would like to call your attention to a couple things. And I don't think it's quite as simple yet, at least for us, as it is for as it may seem. Because, I mean, if it were, we wouldn't be having two Senate hearings in 1 week talking about the implications of this. All intentioned, I think, because they think it's a serious thing to consider. The only exception to what I say is my 14-year-old son said, "Dad, everybody knows what Bitcoins are." And then he went into this long thing. It was about 99% what everybody's saying that we're supposed to be learning right now. So it is out there in some areas. But in the most recent comment by the Bitcoin Foundation, and honestly, they've done a wonderful job here trying to bring us the information. But it says things like, Bitcoin transactions are also private in the sense that blockchain reflects only the public key addresses of Bitcoin senders and recipients and does not reflect the private identity of the owners of those public keys. And then I recognize that it says that if a merchant wants to accept Bitcoins, they can have conditions before they actually accept it. But as it goes down further, it says the technologies are still being developed that will make it be even easier for campaigns to ensure that they comply with donation limits. And I think the point is things are moving so fast at the moment on everybody's knowledge and thinking about this, that I'm a little reluctant to just to jump right into the fray full tilt. I honestly think if we had 30 days or so, and you came back with, you know, something more detailed with respect to what your representations might be, you might probably would get a yes answer out of me, but I'm not ready to do that. And I think the idea that the chair had about us trying to pull together a way to adopt a policy that would satisfy most of these concerns that we're raising might be a good idea. And we do have these drafts that have come out, but frankly, there's clearly interest in the public about this, but to ask the public to respond to those drafts and for us to be able to consider them is pretty hard to do at this point, and feel we really have given it all that's out there to consider.
Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you. I agree with what the Vice Chair and Commissioner Peterson have said. And similarly, the comment that I believe Commissioner Walther was referring to from the Bitcoin Foundation, I think, they also note that Bitcoin contributions are no more or less anonymous than other forms of contributions. And there's no reason why Bitcoin contributions should not be treated in the same way as text messages. As with text messages, campaigns can require the provision of an attestation to personal information as a prerequisite for the acceptance of donations above the allowable limits for anonymous contributions. So even though, as the Vice Chairman discussed, this is a new form of currency, but it does fit within our regulatory framework, and we've been asked a question, and we were able to sort of bend over backwards and spend a lot of time on the text messaging one to make sure that people were able to do that. I think we have an opportunity to do that. That doesn't mean, of course, that I wouldn't be willing to work with my colleagues in the future on an interpretive rule or a rulemaking, but I think that there's enough information here to treat them in the same way we have other relatively new technologies like text messages and also in-kind contributions that happen on a daily basis today. So I, too, will be able to support Draft D today.
Thank you. And you raise an interesting point about the analogy to text messaging. The first time, you will recall, that we got a text messaging AO request, we were not able to issue guidance. And it was only when later requesters came along with more and more information that more commissioners, sufficient number of commissioners were comfortable enough that we knew there were sufficient checks in place to make sure that we had we could obtain the necessary disclosure under the Act that we were able to go forward with that. And, I mean, text messages come from phones, and phones are generally in somebody's name. There's a name attached to the phones. In fact, one of the concerns that we had at the time with the text messaging was, well, what about these burner phones, I'll call them, to use the colloquial expression, and we were told that those phones would not be used under the plans that were submitted to us, so that alleviated our concern on that front. I do think that, you know, it's an interesting balance. We have been able to deal with some fairly complicated issues through the advisory opinion process, but with an advisory opinion on the shortened timeline, and then we just sort of depend on who's out there paying attention and they choose to comment, there isn't really a lot of opportunity to do any outreach to try and solicit more comments. We often don't solicit comments in the rulemaking. We just take what comes. But I think we have that opportunity to make sure that we get a full range of viewpoints on that. And I think this is one in particular where a greater range of viewpoints would be very beneficial to us. As I said, There's no no draft. No one is saying no. But in terms of framing the appropriate regulatory response to this, I think that some of us just feel like we need more information in order to make sure that we make that call in the right way. I will just note a small sound a small note of caution for folks out there who are in the political world or are thinking about bitcoins, that we're not saying no. It's obviously it's up to you, but we have seen committees burned by when investing in volatile entities. And we've seen it with campaigns that invested in the stock market and the stocks went down, and all of a sudden, they didn't have the resources that they thought they had. So I think that that's obviously a call for every political committee to make for themselves what they want to put their resources into and what kind of resources to accept. But it does, I think, pose some special challenges and some risks for folks who are dealing with less traditional investment vehicles that have more volatile values that go up and down. But that's their call. I don't know whether anybody has any further comments or Commissioner Walton.
I do have a question regarding this, where it says technologies are being developed that will make it easier for campaigns to ensure that they comply with donation limits. Do you know what's going on in that regard?
Not from a technical perspective, but I do. I'm told by people who are more technically proficient in this field than I am that there are efforts to reduce the level of anonymity that's involved in bitcoins. But again, that's a technology solution, not a regulatory solution.
Thanks.
But it might inform the regulatory solution.
Right.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Will you entertain a motion?
I will certainly entertain a motion.
So that we can literally go through the motion?
Yes, we will go through the motions.
Madam Chair, with respect to advisory opinion request 2013-15, Conservative Action Fund, I move that the Commission approve agenda document 13-45-B, also known as Draft D.
Thank you. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of agenda document 13-45B, Draft D, on the Conservative Action Fund's request in advisory opinion request 2013-15. And I'm sure were it to pass, you would be happy to authorize the appropriate technical and conforming edits for the staff. Is there any discussion on the motion? All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed?
No.
No?
No.
Motion fails 3-3 with the Vice Chairman, Commissioners Hunter and Peterson voting in favor, and Commissioners Walther, Ravel, and myself voting against. We have not seen the last of bitcoins at the FEC. We will continue to work on these very interesting issues. We thank you for presenting them. I'm sorry we couldn't answer all of your questions today, but I am confident that we will answer your questions at some point in the hopefully not too distant future. Thank you, Mr. Backer. That concludes our discussion of Draft Advisory Opinion 2013-15. The next advisory opinion on the agenda is 2013-16. And let me just note for folks who are following the schedule, we're going to swap the order of 3 and 4 on the agenda. The Vice Chairman is recused on item 3, and in order to not have him hopping back and forth from the table, we're just going to swap the order of the discussion. But right now, we're on agenda item 2, Draft Advisory Opinion 2013-16. Ms. Wallstriker.
Thank you, Chair Weintraub. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda document 13-49 is a draft response to an advisory opinion request submitted by politicalrefund.org. The deadline for this advisory opinion is November 22nd, so I believe this is our last opportunity to consider it. The requester asks whether it may use data obtained from reports filed with the Commission to contact persons who have made contributions to candidates, to inform those contributors of their right to seek refunds of their contributions, and to facilitate requests for refunds. PoliticalRefund.org also asks whether it may display on its website aggregate information about contributors' requests for refunds and whether it may accept advertising on its website and sponsorship of its communications to contributors. The draft concludes that the proposed use of contributor data obtained from the Commission, the proposed display of aggregate information about refund requests, and the acceptance of advertising and sponsorship are consistent with the Act and Commission regulations because PoliticalRefund.org would not use Commission data to solicit contributions or donations or for any commercial purpose. We did not receive any comments on the request or on the draft. If the Commission votes to approve any of the drafts, we ask for authority to make any necessary technical conforming changes. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for council or discussions on the draft? Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This draft went blue rather late last night, so obviously probably didn't give you much chance to write anything that the commission could consider in a written document, but just wanted to see, just at least give you the opportunity if you had any comments on the draft that came out.
The draft is actually one that we agree with, and we're perfectly happy with it.
Just wanted to make tag that base, and we could probably
a happy customer
move forward.
Commissioner Ravel.
Thank you. I just wanted to indicate that I am going to support this draft because the requester has stated that they will only contact donors once a year and will inform them solely that they can request a refund. But I do want to call attention to footnote two of the draft to remind the requester of the rules regarding political committee status. Based on the activity that you have, or your client has indicated in their request, I am concerned that it might be political activity that would be unregulated by the Act. So if politicalrefund.org crosses the $1,000 threshold for expenditures or contributions, the political committee requirements could be triggered. And I just wanted that to be noted. Thank you.
I'll just briefly say I'm not going to be supporting the draft, although I'm happy that you are going to get four votes for an answer, Mr. Backer, on this one. I think it's always better when we can come up with four votes for an answer. This issue has a long track record, and I probably have a longer track record on it than anybody here. The statute prohibits the sale or use of the data from our donor information databases. It strikes me that it is a use, at least as much of a use as the tobacco-free kids were proposing to engage in when they propose to merely send information without asking for anybody to give money back or make any monetary suggestions. They just wanted to send information, and at that time the commission said, no, that's a use, that's prohibited. So I think this is somewhat inconsistent with that, and for that reason I'm not going to be supporting the draft. But as I said, I'm happy that the commission is nevertheless going to be able to issue an advisory opinion on this topic. Commissioner Walther.
I'm going to support the draft. I've been reluctant to, in the past, to come close to anything that appeared to be a profit approach to this, but we can't deny the fact that people look at what we put on file and react to it, and it becomes part of debate as anything else. So I think that's the way I see it. I'm going to support it.
Will you entertain a motion?
I will certainly entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, with respect to advisory opinion request 2013-16, politicalrefund.org, I move that the Commission adopt agenda document number 13-49 and authorize the Office of General Counsel to make any necessary technical and conforming edits.
Thank you. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of draft advisory opinion 2013-16 as set forth in agenda document number 13-49 and to authorize counsel to make any necessary technical and conforming edits. Is there any discussion on the motion? If not, I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion carries 5-1 with the Vice Chairman, Commissioners Hunter, Peterson, Ravel, and Walther voting in favor, and me standing alone voting no. But that's okay.
I'd just like to point out that I think this is the 12th advisory opinion that I've submitted to the FEC, and while I brought bipartisan agreement here before, this is the first one you've ever actually granted. So it's a little disconcerting.
Congratulations.
Is it really the first one we've said yes to?
Yes.
Well, that's interesting.
Shall we all applaud?
I didn't think your track record was that.
Well, you know, if you factor in what happens next, it's not so awful.
Yes, well, you do sometimes come in with requests that you are, I think, somewhat confident you're going to get a no to.
That's when we didn't prepare the balloon drop for our occasion, but next time, give us a heads up.
We weren't paying attention. I'm sorry we didn't have the confetti. Well, I'm glad we were finally able to say yes to you, Mr. Backer, because you do provide us with some interesting topics of discussion. And I'm pretty sure this year you are our best customer on the AO front. As I said, I'm going to swap out the next item on the agenda and move to item four. Brief. This won't take long. The draft interpretive rule regarding date of political party nominations of candidates for special primary elections in New York. Ms. Helmsley, would you like to say something about this?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioners. Good morning. Agenda document 13-48 is a draft interpretive rule addressing the issue of whether the date of a primary in a special election held pursuant to New York election law is the date on which the party committee votes for its nominee or the date on which the party committee files a certification of nomination with the appropriate election board. The Act provides that an election is a general, special, primary, or runoff election or a convention or a caucus of a political party which has the authority to nominate a candidate. Commission regulations define a primary election as an election which is held before the general election, as a direct result of which candidates are nominated in accordance with state law. New York election law vests special election nominating authority in the party committees, either directly or by operation of state party committee rules. The draft interpretive rule clarifies that for purposes of the FECA, the date a New York Party Committee chooses its candidate is the date of the special primary election because the nomination is the direct result of the party election. The subsequent filing of a certification may formalize the nomination for purposes of state law, but is not the primary itself. We would request any authority to make any necessary technical and conforming amendments. Thank you. We'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hemsley. Let me just say that this is a question that came up recently, and it appeared that there was some confusion on the answer to the question of what the exact appropriate date was that folks should be using in New York for their special primary elections. And we thought we ought to make that clear since there was some confusion on the topic. Now, we are not envisioning voting on this today. We're making this draft public in order to provide anyone who's interested the opportunity to comment on it before we do vote on it, which I anticipate could happen at the next meeting. So if anybody out there is interested in this topic and cares to share their views with us, we would be happy to hear that. If we do we need a motion to put this forward, Mr. Inoti?
Historically, the Commission has voted to direct us to put it out for public comment. It's probably not necessary, but that has...
Madam Chair, so moved.
That I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman, for slipping back into your chair in order to make that motion that we, the Vice Chairman has moved that we direct counsel to put the draft interpretive rule regarding date of political party nominations of candidates for special primary elections in New York, as set forth in agenda document number 13-48, to make this document available for public comment. I will, unless someone has anything to say on this, I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Thank you, Ms. Hemsley and Mr. Noti. And we will look forward to any comments that the public chooses to share with us on this. We now revert to what is item 3, formerly item 3 on the agenda, draft advisory opinion 2013-17. And as I noted previously, the vice chairman is recused on this, so he has stepped away from the table. But he stepped out into the studio audience and remains with us and interested, just not going to participate in this one. Ms. Jury, welcome to the table under your new name, and congratulations on your recent wedding.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair Weintraub, and good morning, Commissioners. Before you is agenda document 13-47, which consists of two alternative draft advisory opinions responding to a request from the Tea Party Leadership Fund. The requester is an organization registered with the Commission as a non-connected hybrid political committee. The requester seeks an exemption from various reporting and disclosure requirements of the Act and Commission regulations. The requester asserts that it has established a reasonable probability that disclosing its contributors and the recipients of its disbursements would subject those persons to threats, harassment, or reprisals from governmental officials and private parties. Draft A concludes that the requester is entitled to an exemption from the enumerated reporting and disclosure requirements. Draft B concludes that the requester is not entitled to an exemption from these same requirements. We received one comment on the request, and at last count, 9 comments on the drafts, including one comment filed on behalf of 5,530 signatories. If the Commission votes to approve either draft, we ask for authority to make any necessary technical and conforming changes. Thank you. I would be happy to address any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Do we have any comments on either of the drafts or questions for Council? Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions for Mr. Backer. The first is one of the drafts, Draft B, as well as some of the comments that have been filed with respect to this advisory opinion request, have claimed that that your organization is not necessarily minor enough to be given the exemption, that in terms of the numbers who associate with your group, the amount of money that that you've raised, and the electoral success that some of the candidates that your group has supported have had, that that basically you're too big, too successful for being granted the exemption, the standard of which was set forth in Buckley and then was applied later in the case of Brown versus Socialist Workers 74 Campaign Committee. What's your response to that assertion?
Mr. Becker.
I'm not really sure what the appropriate ratio of success or dollars to government harassment and bullying is. So in my perspective and that of my client, there's an extensive evidentiary trail here. And reasonable minds can just debate whether, you know, is it sufficient bullying, is insufficient bullying, but we believe the scope of the evidence really meets the test that is has been laid out in the past. And ultimately, whatever the standard is, you know, there has to be a standard, and we think we've met it.
Okay. And just a quick follow-up. Another kind of theme in some of the comments is that, well, the some of the incidents that you cite in your, I mean, voluminous record. I think it was 1,400 pages in the original request, and there was an additional, I believe, 300 pages of supplemental materials. So definitely a thick stack of information indicating a variety of different incidents. Some have said that's just the normal rough and tumble of politics, and is that the normal rough and tumble?
I certainly don't agree with that characterization. I think you have a pattern of conduct that is very broad-based and both, you know, horizontally and vertically. You've got harassment and abuse from various federal agencies. You've got public approbation from government officials, elected officials, private actors, the media. I think if it were an isolated incident of one individual here saying something, or, you know, perhaps a member of Congress, you know, that's one thing. But this is a pretty broad pattern of rather aggressive harassment and abuse, bullying, and there's a lot of different words we could use to describe it. I just think that the pervasiveness of this conduct is such that it really is beyond the pale of normal political back and forth.
Okay. Thank you. I just want to add at this point that twice during my tenure here at the Commission, the Commission has voted to extend a reporting exemption for the Socialist Workers Party. And it's been on the basis of factual records that are, in my view, are no stronger than the one that's been set forward by the requester in terms of threats, harassment, vandalism, and so forth, in terms of the factual record that we've seen in recent years. And certainly there was nothing in the record, and though when we considered those exemptions at two different times, that was on par with the Treasury Inspector General's report with respect to to what happened with at the IRS, where the just to quote one of the highlights from the report, it says that the IRS used inappropriate criteria that identified for reviews Tea Party and other organizations applying for tax-exempt status based upon their names or policy positions instead of indications of potential political campaign intervention. So in essence, they were singled out for inappropriate scrutiny by the IRS. And so while it's true that the Tea Party organization is in your organization is how many years old?
May of 12, so we're about a year and a half.
Okay, so it's a relatively young organization. So, but that's not necessarily all that relevant when applying the test that was set forth in Buckley, which we cite in draft A, talks about how a newly formed party that has no history upon which to draw may offer evidence of reprisals and threats directed against individuals or organizations holding similar views. And I believe that that's what you have done in terms of the materials that you've presented to the commission along with your request. When trying to apply the standard that's in Buckley, where it talks about the reasonable probability that its contributors will be subjected to threats, harassment, reprisals, you know, applying something in the abstract can sometimes be difficult. I think that oftentimes we look for analogs, we look for comparisons, and what I have to compare it to is when we extended the exemptions in the Socialist Workers Party advisory opinions, the first one, which was, I believe, in 2009, and then earlier this year we issued this a continued exemption until December 31st of 2016. And my thought is if considering that I think the record is just as strong, if not stronger, in this particular matter than it was there, that if the Socialist Workers Party is entitled to the reporting exemption, then I think so is your organization. I think if we say no to you, then I think that does call into question the continuing viability of the exemption that we do give to the Socialist Workers Party. But I'm prepared to support draft A, which would provide you this exemption. Again, I think these are always interesting cases in that, unlike our typical advisory opinions, we're in the position of basically examining as-applied challenges in accordance with the case law that's before us. But I think that having read the case law and having read and looking at the one thing I noted when reading the Brown versus Socialist Workers Party case from I guess it's in the early 80s, that the focus in that case seemed to be less upon whether or not they were small than on the nature of the threats, the harassment, the violence, the official, you know, the official misconduct that may have been directed toward that group. And I think that that's relevant for consideration when determining whether or not such an exemption should be also extended to your organization that you're representing. So, like I said, at the appropriate time, I'd be willing to support draft A, which would provide that exemption.
Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, would be willing to support draft A, and I'd like to associate myself with the comments of Commissioner Peterson. I agree with him that once we adopted the Socialist Workers' Party exemption, the record in this case is as strong, if not stronger, than in that advisory opinion request. I think the best evidence is also the one that the Commissioner Peterson cited, the Inspector General's report of harassment of the Tea Party by the Internal Revenue Service. I don't know how it can get much worse than that. I would also support an amendment to draft A if we vote on this at the appropriate time to terminate the exemption at the same time that we terminated the exemption for the Socialist Workers Party, which was, I believe, December of 2016. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll say for myself, the analysis of whether, you know, this person has been harassed as much as, more than, less than another entity doesn't end the analysis. My vote in the Socialist Workers Party was really determined by the fact that we had an entity that had never supported a winning candidate, and we had so few supporters that there were only 11 donors who had given more than $200. So that was the sum total of what the public was losing, was the names of those 11 donors to a party that had never supported a winning candidate. So to me, that is a very important distinction that we need to balance, and that's what the Supreme Court has told us. We need to balance the need for information, the right of the electorate to be informed about who is supporting candidates and political groups, and that needs to be balanced against whatever other record the group may bring to us. As I will quote. I rarely quote Justice Scalia, but when I do, it's usually this quote. I will quote Justice Scalia from Doe v. Reed. There are laws against threats and intimidation. And just interject, of course, none of us want anyone to be subjected to threats and intimidation. And going on with the quote, harsh criticism short of unlawful action is a price our people have traditionally been willing to pay for self-governance. Requiring people to stand up in public for their political acts fosters civic courage, without which democracy is doomed. I think that when you have an organization that is so successful and attracts so many donors and supports so many winning candidates, is influencing the national debate, is most people credit the Tea Party. Some people credit them, some people blame them for the government shutdown earlier this year. There are candidates, there are successful members of Congress who have been supported by your organization who are proud to claim the allegiance of to the Tea Party cause and are proud to be associated with it. And this is, I think it is... it also affects the analysis of the extent of the harassment in a way, because certainly they are having people stand up on the floor of the Senate as members of the Senate proudly proclaiming their Tea Party stripes is very, very different from what the Socialist Workers went through, where a member of the Senate was holding hearings in order to persecute the members of those parties. There certainly has been no moment akin to the at long last have you no decency moment that the Socialist Workers Party went through. Now, one can certainly argue that maybe that was a long time ago and we should move on and take away their exemption at this point. And I seriously considered it both times that it's come before us. But as I said, what ultimately made the difference to me was that we were only talking about 11 donors, supporters of unsuccessful candidates. And what we're faced with here is a multi-million dollar organization with hundreds and thousands of donors. And the public really would, I think, suffer from not having that information and would be a less well-informed electorate. So I will be supporting Draft B. Commissioner Waltham?
Just for the record, I'll support Draft B, but I think, just to make a record, I didn't support the earlier exemptions that this commission had voted for in 2009 and 2012. And I fall a little more in the category of Justice Scalia, and like the chair, I don't quote him often, and I was going to do that today, but frankly, I really think there was a justification when you look back in the very early days of the Socialist Worker Party when there was true danger and risk, and the public was really reacting in violent ways. And so that exemption still never did reach the light of day in terms of having a court opinion, a rule that an exemption was appropriate. After that was filed originally, a long time ago, stipulation was reached whereby the commission would review periodically whether or not to continue to grant the exemption, so it was not a permanent one. And each time, in my view, while the in considering the fact that it really is a two-pronged test. Size, partially due, I think, to the idea is, does the public have an interest in knowing everything there is to know about an entity that only gets 11 contributions? Is that really that big a deal in terms of the overall need for free speech? But secondly, whether or not there was a true risk to the, principally to the donors. And so we, I think, as we, as time went on, the justification for the exemption for the Socialist Worker Parties became weaker and weaker. And I think there was a point where the commission felt the same way. Last time, I didn't see that. I was a lone dissenter. But in a case like this, where you have the Tea Party, which is really shown to have a lot of muscle, and a lot of people are giving money to it. It's not a minor organization, and I don't think the evidence shows that there's the donors are really worried about threats to themselves and personal safety issues of the kind that really existed when the Socialist Workers' Parties first got their exemption.
Commissioner Rample.
Thank you. The reporting disclosure requirements that the FEC is mandated to enforce, I think, are the central aspect of our mission, and that's what we are here to protect. So, although the courts have permitted a very narrow exception, as described by my colleagues in two circumstances, my view is that what you have described, and I read it very carefully. I looked through all of the statements and all of the incidents that you talk about, as well as the report. My view is that it doesn't meet those provisions for the for either reason, either that you are a minor party or organization, or the Tea Party group that you represent as a minor party or organization, or that the harassment reaches the kind of harassment that is the historical backdrop of the court decisions that speak to this issue. And in particular, and I was pretty, I was very influenced by the October 18th letter that was submitted to us by, I believe it was Herbert and Wertheimer, discussing the circumstances surrounding the NAACP versus Alabama case. And, you know, certainly is probably one of the older members, well, maybe not, of the commission. that
you have to say that.
That was a time period that I lived through. And frankly, the reprisals, the harassment that was the historic backdrop to this exemption, this very narrow exemption, I believe is so extreme and of such a major problem for our democracy that is why that exemption was crafted in the law and in Supreme Court cases. With respect to the socialist workers matter, I was not present when that AO was discussed, and I have not had the opportunity to read through any of the documents or any of the reasoning that led to the AO. And certainly, if it came before us again, I would look at it afresh, as I would do any other matter. So I do not believe that I would be bound by whatever that determination was. So generally, I, too, will be supporting Draft B.
Well, unless we have further comments, I believe we could entertain some motions. Commissioner Wolf.
I move the commission accept Draft B.
Commissioner Walther has moved approval of Draft B in Advisory Opinion request 2013-17, as set forth in agenda document 13-47, and I assume that also includes the authority for council to make appropriate technical and conforming amendments. Is there any discussion on the motion? If not, I'll call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
No.
Motion fails, 3-2, with Commissioners Walther, Ravel, and myself voting in favor, and Commissioners Hunter and Peterson voting against. Do we have any other motions? Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There were a couple of small things that I wanted to add to my draft late last night, but then I figured it, I knew kind of where the writing on the wall was on this, so I didn't feel like it was necessary to put out a blue draft, but just for the sake of, the completeness of the record, I'll move draft A with the following two amendments. Both of which are on page 7 of our draft. The first on line 1, we have the partial sentence ending in campaign signs, and then in parenthetically exhibit F-12. I would like to insert a sentence that reads, "Perhaps the most significant is the report of the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration that concluded that, quote, the IRS used an appropriate criteria that identified for review Tea Party and other organizations applying for tax exempt status based upon their names or policy positions instead of indications of potential political campaign intervention," close quote, and then in parentheses, exhibit A-1, little a. That's the exhibit that came with. And then one further amendment would be at the end of the sentence on line 20, include the sentence, "The commission grants this exemption to reports covering through December 31st, 2016. Like I said, that's for the completeness of the record.
Absolutely.
Understanding exactly where things are headed.
Thank you. Commissioner Peterson has moved approval of draft A, as set forth in agenda document number 13-47, and as amended as described at the table, and to authorize council to make any technical and conforming edits that might be necessary should the motion pass. We have any discussion on the motion? If not, I'll call the question. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? No.
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 Motion fails 2-3, with Commissioners Hunter and Peterson voting in favor, and Commissioner Walther, Ravel, and myself voting against. I just want to close by saying certainly no one at this table wishes to condone any form of harassment for anyone who is trying to express their political views in any way. And I would note that on the Hill, when allegations were raised, that there was bipartisan outcry and any number of congressional hearings that have sought to get to the bottom of any claims of targeting or harassment by the government of anyone for expressing their political views, and appropriately so. So, I guess you're 1-for-3 today, Mr. Backer. But you got one.
Pretty good.
Better than a AAA player, so.
There you go. Thank you for submitting those interesting requests. Mr. Staff Director, do we have any management or administrative matters to discuss?
Madam Chair, there are no such matters.
In that case, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much, everybody.
Congratulations.